I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free. A diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect. I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced, I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond. I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive. Behind the eight ball, ahead of the curve, riding the wave, dodging the bullet, pushing the envelope. I'm on point, on task, on message, and off drugs. I got no need for coke and speed. I got no urge to binge and purge. I'm in the moment, on the edge, over the top, but under the radar. A high-concept, low-profile, medium-range, ballistic mission. A streetwise smart bomb, a top gun bottom feeder. I wear power ties, I tell power lies, I take power naps, I run victory laps. I'm a totally ongoing Bigfoot slam dunk rainmaker with a proactive outreach. A raging workaholic, a working rageaholic, out of rehab and in denial. I got a personal trainer, a personal shopper, a personal assistant, and a personal agenda. You can't shut me up, you can't dumb me down, because I'm tireless and I'm wireless. I'm an alpha male on beta blockers. I'm a non-believer and an overachiever, laid back but fashion forward. Up front, down home, low rent, high maintenance. Supersized, long-lasting, high-definition, fast-acting, oven-ready and built to last. I'm a hands-on, footloose, knee-jerk head case, prematurely post-traumatic, and I have a love child who sends me hate mail. But I'm feeling, I'm caring, I'm healing, I'm sharing. A supportive, bonding, nurturing primary caregiver. My output is down, but my income is up. I take a short position on the long bond, and my revenue stream has its own cash flow. I read junk mail, I eat junk food, I buy junk bonds, I watch trash sports. I'm gender-specific, capital-intensive, user-friendly, and lactose-intolerant. I like rough sex. I like tough love. I use the F word in my email, and the software on my hard drive is hardcore, no soft porn. I bought a microwave at a mini mall. I bought a minivan at a megastore. I eat fast food in the slow lane. I'm toll-free, bite-sized, ready-to-wear, and I come in all sizes. A fully equipped, factory-authorized, hospital-tested, clinically proven, scientifically formulated medical miracle. I've been pre-washed, pre-cooked, pre-heated, pre-screened, pre-approved, pre-packaged, post-dated, freeze-dried, double-wrapped, vacuum-packed, and I have an unlimited broadband capacity. I'm a rude dude, but I'm the real deal. Lean and mean, cocked, locked, and ready to rock. Rough, tough, and hard to bluff. I take it slow, I go with the flow, I ride with the tide, I got glide in my stride. Driving and moving, sailing and spinning, jiving and grooving, wailing and winning. I don't snooze, so I don't lose. I keep the pedal to the metal and the rubber on the road. I party hardy, and lunchtime is crunch time. I'm hanging in, there ain't no doubt, and I'm hanging tough, over and out.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts with Richard Haass, and he is interviewed by E.J. Dionne about Foreign Policy Begins at Home.
Next, Richard Haass argues that for the U.S. to retain its primacy in the 21st century, it must reduce its involvement in foreign interventions, both military and humanitarian, and focus instead on restoring its own economic health.
Very honored to be here with my friend Richard Haass, and I'm here for a couple of reasons. The first is that Richard and I go really far back. I don't want to tell you how far back, but we met when we were 21 years old, and you can do the math. And so I've been Richard's friend and have followed his thinking, agreeing with some, disagreeing with some over the years, but he's always been my friend. But I'm here because I was very excited about this book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, from the very moment I heard the title and then from the first conversation I had with Richard about it. Richard and I were colleagues together at the Brookings Institution, and actually the first question I'm going to ask of you, Richard, is, given this title, why don't you just merge the Council on Foreign Relations with the Brookings Institution? Because that would be a very logical thing to do in light of the title. But I think this book makes an argument that I believe we need to hear, and that I think a lot of Americans will actually resonate to. I read the book, Richard, and I wondered, is this your manifesto to run for president? So I can ask him that question, too. And when he is at all equivocal, we can know that he is running for president.
EJ, I am president.
I was going to get to that. I just want to read a couple of lines from the book, which I think summarize it. Americans will not enjoy the standard of living or quality of life they aspire to at home amid chaos abroad, and the United States will not be in a position to limit chaos abroad unless it rebuilds the foundations of its strength at home. And then later on, he said the objective must be to take advantage of the opportunity we have now, which Richard calls a strategic respite, to restore the foundations of American power, including the economy, the schools, infrastructure. I think that we should be grateful that Richard has joined the debate in this way. As you know, Richard is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's worked in almost every administration in our lifetime. He is the author and editor of 12 books. And I will start by asking you, why not merge the CFR with Brookings? But what I really want to do is ask you, what pushed you in this direction? There are those who say that this is an isolationist book. I have read it. It's not an isolationist book. I want you to begin by defending yourself against that charge and just explain, how did you come to this?
Well, let me say at the beginning, it's not a book I ever imagined I'd write. Here I am. I'm lucky enough to be president of the Council on Foreign Relations. I've spent four decades toiling in what you might call the foreign policy national security vineyard. Like many others in this room, I grew up during the Cold War, and yet I got to this point. What did it was really two things. If I had to sum it up in a sentence, it's because the United States is overreached abroad and we've underperformed at home, and I'm worried as a result. I think we overreached abroad over the last few decades, first in Iraq, and then secondly in Afghanistan, when we tried to remake that country. And as I watch some of the debates going on about Syria, I'm concerned that we don't seem to have lost that. We don't seem to have learned that lesson. Indeed, as recently as today in the New York Times, people were saying it's time already to get over Iraq. Gee, I don't want to get over Iraq. I want to learn the lessons of Iraq, and I want to apply those lessons. So I'm worried that the United States is seriously overreached and has been, it's allowed its foreign policy to get distorted with this emphasis in particular on the Middle East, in particular on remaking the Middle East, which I simply is not believe is neither possible nor is strategically wise given the other things we have to do in Asia, in this part of the world, in North America. But then it gets me to the second half of the argument. I'm also worried about what we're doing and not doing here at home. And I can't believe any observer of the American political scene would conclude differently. If one looks at what we haven't done dealing with the deficit, if one looks at the fact that we're growing at a rate that's roughly half the post-World War II historical average, if anyone's landed in recent memory at LaGuardia or Kennedy Airport, I rest my case on infrastructure. If I know a lot of kids line up around the world to get into Harvard, Yale, Princeton, or Stanford. I haven't noticed long lines of children around the world trying to come into the United States to attend our elementary schools, our public schools. So there are some real challenges here at home, and I'm worried that our politics are simply not up to sorting them out. So I wrote the book essentially to make the case for what we need to do abroad and what we need to do at home and what we need to stop doing abroad and stop doing at home, but also to help people sort it out. It's a complicated world. This is a far more complicated world than the world I alluded to a second ago, the Cold War. And what I've tried to do is write something blueprints too strong of her, but a guide to essentially for citizens as well as policymakers for sorting out the challenges of the 21st century.
One of the things, by the way, you'll learn in the book is that 10 years ago we were fifth in the world in infrastructure, and now we're 24th in the world, which goes to Richard's point. Let's go straight to the Middle East. When I read those parts of the book where you talked about the need to readjust toward Asia, you dislike the word pivot, which you can explain. I was thinking we may no longer be as interested as we used to be in the Middle East, but the Middle East always seems interested in us. And this administration very clearly wants to make the move toward Asia, is trying to make that move, and yet issues in the Middle East keep coming back. Sure. How do we actually manage to make that move, given all the problems that you described so well in the book that exist in the Middle East?
Well, the analogy that comes to mind for those of you who like to stay up at night watching films is Michael in Godfather 3. And he basically says, every time I try to leave, they keep pulling me back. Well, that wasn't just him with the mafia. That's us with the Middle East. We say we want to pivot or rebalance towards Asia or other parts of the world, and suddenly we wake up and the headlines are Libya, Syria, Iran, what have you. But foreign policy, like all public policy, is about choosing. Foreign policy, like all public policy, is about priorities. To borrow from the business literature, it's sometimes about not letting the urgent crowd out the important. And what we have to do is look at not simply the Middle East, or to use the cliche, one square on the chessboard. We've got to look at the entire chessboard. And we've got to look at, the Middle East compared to everything else we may want to do in other parts of the world or here at home. But also, we've got to know something about the Middle East. One of the things we ought to have learned from Vietnam, from Iraq, and from Afghanistan is we can sit around inside the Beltway and debate this or that generalization or foreign policy abstraction, but at some point, it comes up against local realities, geographic, historical, cultural, political, economic. There are real realities in the Middle East, and we may say we want Syria in the next 6 months or a year to be a peaceful, thriving democracy where everybody's reading the Federalist Papers in Arabic translation. No, fine. I wish you well. Ain't going to happen. And then as a result, we've got to adjust our foreign policy accordingly. Or to put it another way, if we had had this meeting a decade ago or 15 years ago, and we had had a show of hands, inconceivable that we would have predicted that U.S. foreign policy in this post-Cold War era would involve going to war first in Iraq and then Afghanistan, parts of the greater Middle East. That essentially this was going to be where the United States was going to use its discretionary power. This was how we were going to use the peace dividend. We were going to try to remake this part of the world. It's what we did, but this seems to me to be totally inconsistent with any notion of strategy.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Yeah. It's another life, please.
now back to Foreign Policy Begins at Home with Richard Haass and E.J. Dionne.
This goes back to your other book, but you were in the administration that went to war in Iraq. Why was it so difficult to stop the war in Iraq, to stop the direction of the administration? There are a lot of people in there, you and Colin Powell and Richard Armitage, all had grave doubts about what we were doing before we did it. What led us there? Why could that not be stopped?
It's something I've written a lot about, actually, in a previous book. But the three people you mentioned all happened to be in one building, the State Department. Last I checked, there are several other buildings involved in the making of foreign policy, beginning with the White House. And after 9/11, there were those around the president, and I think the president signed on to this as well, that he wanted to do something that would send a message to the world that we were not a pitiful, helpless giant, to use Mr. Nixon's phrase. There was also the view that was argued by some, which I thought was preposterous, that that Iraq was ripe for democracy. It was going to be easily instituted there, and then it would establish a model that the rest of the region wouldn't be able to resist. So essentially, if you had if people come into the Oval Office or any executive's office and say, I can accomplish great things at very low costs, people usually say, where do they sign up? And then, to be fair, against that was also the belief, proven wrong and subsequently, but we didn't know at the time, that the Iraqis did have weapons. We thought they did have weapons of mass destruction. It was in the aftermath of 9/11 where people's tolerance for risk was low. I argued against it at the time, but I don't think, if you will, it was a totally foolish undertaking. I think it was ill-advised. I think it was wrong. But I think there were arguments for doing it, again, based on the assumption that the Iraqis did have weapons of mass destruction. Absent that, then no, I don't think it was even, I don't think it was a close call. And what worried me about it was that if we were going to do it, we didn't go about it right. And even at the time, the CIA warned, and people such as myself warned, that to do this right would take considerable planning, again, given local realities. And a lot of what happened after the United States went in was predictable. And that's, again, to me, what was so frustrating. Whatever you thought of the wisdom of going to war with Iraq or Afghanistan or any of these places, put that aside. But we did, well, there was no reason we couldn't have known more and prepared for what it was going to entail, given what we were walking into. And there's no excuse for not getting it right. And again, there's no substitute at times for local knowledge. And we forget that at our peril. And one of the things that so concerns me about the debate about Syria is the lack of local knowledge that's being brought to bear.
One of the things I liked about the book is that it is very much not a declinist book. In fact, its whole purpose is to fight the possibility of decline. Here's a sentence I particularly liked. Lost in the emotionally laden territory between we're number one and we've lost it is a country that still matters far more than any other. You note that our GDP is 16 trillion, a fourth of global economic output, compared to 7 trillion for China, 6 trillion for Japan. Our GDP is per capita is nine times that of China. Can you talk about the declinism and the alternatives and how this book fits into that debate?
Yeah, it's funny to sometimes define yourself in terms of what you're not, but I feel forced to in some ways, because it was predictable that I'd be charged with being an isolationist on one hand and a declinist on the other. Neither is at all true. The whole argument of the book, by the way, is that we need to do more at home, not to turn our backs on the world, but so that over time we're in a better position to shape the world. And by the way, if we don't shape it, no one else will. You know, the alternative to a U.S.-led world is not a world that's wonderful. You know, there's no invisible hand out there. Adam Smith doesn't run the world. So it will be chaotic. And it's not going to be a China-led world or an India-led world or a Europe-led world or a Japan-led world. It's going to be an unled world if we're not willing and able to do it. This is not an argument for American unilateralism, but it is an argument for American leadership. And again, we're only going to be in a position to exert that leadership if we fix ourselves here at home. So that's why the book is not isolationist. And again, you know, we can't become a gated community. What happens out there is going to affect our quality of life, our physical security, our economic wealth, like it or not. We're not declining in absolute terms. We're growing. We might be growing slowly at 1.5, 1.75 rate, half of what we should be growing at, but we're growing. And other parts of the world have real challenges, even though in some cases relatively they're doing better than us. That's to be expected, because they're starting at a much lower rate. But what worries me is we're underperforming. We know that. So it's not a question of whether we're declining. The question is we're not doing as well as we should. We've got, again, the problems we talked about before, from crumbling infrastructure to schools that aren't beginning to prepare people for living in a global world. We know we don't have the resources set aside to deal with the baby boomers as they retire and as their health care needs mount. We all know that. So, you know, what is it going to take to deal with these obligations? What is it going to take to double the rate of growth of the American economy? That's the debate we need to have. So it's not this abstract debate about whether we're in decline. We're not. Let's put that aside. The real question is, are we on a trajectory that we need to be on in order to have the kind of society and economy we want here at home and to be in a position to shape the kind of world we want to shape in the 21st century? The answer is no. So let's not have this silly debate about decline. Let's not have the silly debate about whether we're isolationists. The serious debate is, how do we get it right? How do we begin to live up to our potential?
For the record, I want to note he never did answer that question I asked him about running for president of the United States. I am Catholic, so I particularly enjoyed the emphasis you put on the importance of doctrine. And I found that part of the book particularly interesting, because you talk about the utility of having, the usefulness of having a doctrine, and you sort of toss out several possibilities and then reject them. You know, one is democracy promotion, saving lives, taking on terrorist integration, and you end up with another doctrine that tries to pull in some of those. Can you, Cardinal, talk about your doctrine? Or Rabbi?
let me first make the case for doctrine. And the reason is, you want some kind of a framework, because when you're sitting in these jobs, or simply as a citizen, stuff's coming at you fast and furious. And, you know, in retrospect, when you have congressional investigations or journalists write about it, it's obvious what you should have paid attention to. But normally when you have an inbox, things don't come in with blinking red lights that say, pay attention to me, I'm what matters most. So what a doctrine does is it helps you sort. It helps you sift. It gives you some first order direction or guidance about what matters most, or what to do or not to do. And to try to conduct policy as a policymaker, or to try to simply be an informed citizen where you wake up every day without a doctrine, is a little bit like Groundhog Day. It's tough. There's just no sorting. There's no way to determine priorities. So doctrines matter. There's lots of different things you could choose, and there's all sorts of ideas out there. Mine is this idea of restoration. And what it does is basically says, in the foreign policy world, we ought to put less emphasis on the Middle East and more on Asia, which matters, I believe, the most, because that's where the great powers are colliding. It's also where the tools we have to bring to bear tend to be have the greatest amount of utility. I think we also ought to focus more on North America. That's where the energy is, and that's where the economic growth for the world is going to come from.
In a foreign field he lay, lonely soldier, unknown grave. On his dying words he prays, tell the world of Passchendaele. We live all that he's been through, last communion of his soul. Rust your bullets with his tears, let me tell you about his years. Laying low in a blood-filled trench, killing time from a very own death. On my face I can feel the falling rain, never see my friends. Shouts and more guns fire, left his bodies hang on barbed wire. Battlefield, nothing but a bloody doom. Been reunited with my dead friend soon. Many soldiers, 18 years, dreading mud, no more tears. Surely a war no one can win. Killing time about to begin. Home, far away.
See my spirit on the wind, across the lands beyond the hill. Friend and foe will meet again, those who died at Passchendaele.
And now for something completely different.